My future has shrunk like a sweater steeped in hot water. So says Madeline May Kunin, looking at her life as governor, ambassador, and now her journey to her 80s. Next on Through the Eyes of Women. Welcome to Through the Eyes of Women, a program featuring the lives and perspectives of women, local, national, and international. Madeline Kunin has lived a life of being first, the first and only female governor of Vermont, the first female governor to serve three terms, where she appointed the first woman to the Vermont Supreme Court, and she is the first Jewish woman to be elected governor of any U.S. state. Author Madeline Kunin has written four books, Living a Political Life, The New Feminist Agenda, Defining the Next Revolution for Women, Work, and Family, and Pearls, Politics, and Power. Her latest book is also a first, as she ventures into her coming of age, old age, as she shares her physical, emotional, and private tales with poetry and prose and grace. The book is called Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s, a memoir by Madeline May Kunin. Welcome to Through the Eyes of Women, Governor Kunin.
I'm delighted to join you. Thank you.
I call you governor, but I could also call you ambassador, as you were ambassador to both Switzerland and Liechtenstein, and you were also the deputy secretary of education during the Clinton administration. My favorite was that you started out as a reporter, though.
Right.
You've had quite a life of accomplishment and excitement. I wonder, with so many firsts in your life, how has that, or has that, given you the courage to face the last years of your life with such intensity and honesty?
Well, a new title, which is poet and writer. So as I've gotten older, my outlook on life has begun to change. Now, when you're in public life, you live very carefully in some ways. You have to watch what you say, how you dress, how you appear to the public, and you sort of have to put your words through a screen or sieve to keep out anything that might be negative or dangerous. But as I got older, I realized I could say whatever I damn please. And I sort of just shed this outward protective covering and became more introspective. I mean, you can't really be a poet when you're in public life. At least I couldn't, when your schedule changes every 15 minutes. But now I have more time to meditate, to turn inward, and try to express my feelings and observations about growing older.
Now, there's poetry throughout the book. Often it's before a chapter, maybe after a chapter. And I was wondering today at one point if you would read one of your favorite poems for us.
Yes, I could do that. I'll read one of the first poems in the book called No Longer. No longer will we make love before breakfast. No longer will I dream of seeing New Zealand and the Cape of Good Hope, or bears in the wild. No longer will I say yes more than no. No longer will danger sparkle and safety look dull. No longer will I look at my body without comparison between who I was and who I have become, blaming the light for the difference. No longer can I toss my hair over my face and count 100 strokes. No longer can I do without night cream and day cream, slathering on ounce after ounce. No longer can I be comfortable sitting in my chair, reading for hours, without getting up to stretch my arms and legs. No longer can I walk without looking down at my feet to avoid mean cracks and malicious bumps. No longer can I skip downstairs like a girl, flying without feeling a thing. No longer can I approach the precipice without swaying against my will. No longer do I think ahead of where I will be in 10 years or 20 or more. Now I think in ones or twos or threes, long enough to still hunger for the food of life. No longer do I wish for the next day or the next year to come quickly, like I did the year I turned 10. I want the days to saunter like a leisurely museum stroller who stops now and then to gaze and get closer to the canvas to see the brush strokes, and then steps back for the long view before moving on.
Thank you so much. Talk about moving on. Your book is dedicated to John W. Hennessy Jr., your second husband, who died earlier this year, I believe right after you wrote the book. Can you talk about him a little and your love life with him?
He died just about a year from now, on January 11th, and we both found love at a late stage of life, and it was quite wonderful. We just had a lot in common, and he met two of my basic criteria. He was a Democrat, and two, he was a feminist. And he was also dean of the Tuck School of Management at Dartmouth. So he had unusual attributes for a dean of a business school. And it was just so easy. We just found each other.
And he said to you, I can give you 10 good years of my life. And
yes.
What did that mean then, and what does it mean now?
Well, at the time, it seemed like forever. I didn't calculate those years. But now that more than 10 years are up, it seems a short time. And of course, loss, no matter at what age, is difficult and something you have to learn to live with again.
Well, he was an extraordinary man. He certainly loved powerful, intelligent women. and you mentioned in the book, you quote Gloria Steinem when she said, "We have become the men we wanted to marry."
Yes. In my 20s, I thought I'd like to marry a politician or someone in public life, that would be an exciting and interesting and stimulating life. But I ended up doing it myself, which is, you know, what's typical of today's generation, as we see in the last election. So many women with different backgrounds got elected in the U.S. House of Representatives. So I've been preaching that to women ever since I got elected. Get in the game and run for office where you can really make a difference.
Not only make a difference, you said I would become we. And I felt that it was very important to put the I down and to become the we. And in order to be a good politician, I think you have to do that. In order to be a good public servant, you have to do that.
Right.
Now, let's talk about your involvement with women in politics. Over 10 years ago, you started Emerge Vermont. So I bet that was very exciting last November, the election, 10 years after you initiated that, to see the success behind that.
Yes. I mean, this has been what they call a banner year. And I guess some of the credit goes to Trump, because he really ignited women's energy. You know, instead of complaining at the Women's March 2 years ago, people really said, I've got to do something. And of course, the most direct way to create change is to run for office where you have a seat at the table. And this year, the idea just exploded. And I think it's going to continue with more and more women getting engaged. And that shouldn't be a radical idea. That's just a Democratic with a small d idea, that our governing bodies should look like their constituencies. And we still have a long way to go till we're at 50%. But at least we're making progress much more quickly than we had before.
I know. I don't know if it's a small revolution. It looks like a big revolution to me.
Yes, it is. It is. And we hope the dynamics of it will affect more and more people, more and more women, and even men with different backgrounds. That's a healthy sign. Until recently, you had to be very wealthy, or you had to come from a political family to get recognition. And that still is true, but not as broadly and as widely as it used to be.
Now, let's talk a little bit about your family. Your brother was a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and Edgar also had a political career as well. How was that between siblings?
I don't know how it happened, but as my older brother, he was 4 years older than me. I looked up to him, and We both got into journalism. My first job in Vermont was as a newspaper reporter. And then we both got into politics, and it just seemed we were drawn to similar kind of life. I actually got elected 2 years before he did, so you could say he followed me, but I think he had ideas of his own. And it was interesting when we were both in the Vermont legislature. Sometimes he got tired of the roll call vote. His name was Edgar May, and mine Madeline Cunin. So K came before M in the roll call, and he got upset when one of his colleagues said, "Hey, you're voting with your sister again." And he didn't like that one bit. So one day he asked the clerk to call the roll backwards, and that confused everybody because they didn't know how to vote or when to vote.
Oh, boy.
But we were on the same page, I'd say 98% of the time.
And in very different roles.
Yes.
One controlling the purse strings 1 year, another one controlling the legislature. And that must have been a wonderful experience for you.
It was. And when we differed on anything, eyebrows were raised. We said, "What's going on with the brother and sister?" But we were very similar in terms of our values and priorities.
Well, today we see another woman throw her hat in the ring. We've come a long way from Victoria Woodhull, Margaret Chase Smith, Shirley Chisholm, and Hillary Clinton as the first nominated woman to run for president. I wonder, I guess that was never an aspiration of yours since you were born in Switzerland, so you didn't have to think about trying to break that glass ceiling.
Right. There may have been other reasons, too. It's such a tough ball game today. But it is exciting that three women have announced they're exploring the race for president. I never thought that would happen so quickly. When Hillary ran twice, I thought, well, she's the only woman who can do this. But now other women are on the same plane, and they're highly competitive.
Well, the competition in politics, in gender politics, is kind of, you know, sort of broaching its equal terms. But as far as what women have to wear, that's another story. You write about being a proud, vain woman and how to cope with that as you look in the mirror. Could you talk about that and also what women wear?
What women wear is still more complicated than what men wear. I mean, men have the standard uniform. The navy blue suit, and now it seems to be the red tie or the pink tie, but they don't have to look over their wardrobe and say, what will make me look presidential or what will make me look electable. So what women have to encompass, and their clothes play a huge role in this, sort of masculine and feminine. They have to be masculine enough to be commander-in-chief and to be authoritative. But if they're too masculine, they're sometimes considered aloof or not likable. So they have to be feminine enough to be authentic. I mean, that's the big challenge for any candidate, is to be authentic, not to look like they're faking it or trying to be someone they're not. So women still have to calibrate that masculine-feminine leadership pose very carefully, not to go too far on one side of the equation or the other. And I think the new cast of congresswomen have stretched that further, that they can be more of themselves. And that's one of the liberating things I experienced when I stopped being in public life. I can wear whatever I want. And that's kind of fun and freeing in a way. You don't have to fit into a mold.
It must be incredible for you to watch that and also to feel that in your own body right now.
Yes, and also, you know, to watch other women, how they're not going by the old rules. They're inventing new rules.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Through the Eyes of Women here on KHSU. I'm your host, Brenda Starr, and my guest is Madeline May Cunin, author of Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. Governor, I want to ask you, who inspires you? Who did inspire you as a young woman and even today?
Well, I think it was several people. And I came of age in the 70s when two almost global movements burst upon the scene. The environmental movement inspired me to take action to protect the environment. That was before climate change, where it was about clean water, clean air, and avoiding toxic elements. And the other movement, which really grabbed me with a strong hold, was the feminist movement, which told me you could do this now, even if you have had four children, and the youngest was in preschool. And those two movements said, I want to be at the table, I want to be engaged. And luckily, I started out with a seat in the legislature, which in Vermont is part-time. Now, as far as figures, people inspire me. I go all the way back to Eleanor Roosevelt. My mother used to read her column, My Day, every day, and she was a real inspiration. Not that she was elected, but she took on issues globally. She fought for civil rights. She fought for human rights. So she inspired me. And then, I just picked up pieces here and there and put together a model that I wanted to become. And I guess also the fact that I wasn't born in the United States, that we came to America at the outbreak of World War II, made me believe in democracy, that it worked. And you have to have sort of an optimistic outlook that you can make a difference, that if you jump into the fray, it will matter. And that's how I was brought up. My mother would say to me and my brother, anything is possible in America. And that stuck with both of us.
Yes. As you mentioned, you kind of immersed yourself in the new feminist literature, the second wave. You mentioned books, The Second Sex by Simone de Beauvoir, The Feminist Mystique by Betty Friedan, Sexual Politics by Kate Millett, Female Eunuch, Germaine Greer, and Sisterhood is Powerful, edited by Robin Morgan. All of those books that we all read in the 70s that formulated for us our ideas and kind of concretized them. Another book that influenced me back then was Shulamith Firestone's The Dialectic of Sex.
Oh, yes.
She was 25, which was a few years older than I was at the time, but I thought, how could this woman write all of this? And that was a very exciting time. Did that pretty much give you the impetus to go into public service?
Yes. We were all talking about it. I thought at one point, after my children were all in college, that I would experiment with going into politics. But the feminist movement of the 60s and 70s said, you can do it now. And I found I liked it. I talked to a man who was active in Vermont politics for advice, whether I should run or not. And I said, what if I'm no good at it? And he looked at me and he said, well, if you're no good at it, you won't stand out. That's how I got inspired to run.
Well, you have to have a lot of courage to run. I know that.
Yeah, either courage or just inspired.
Inspired. As we saw these 100 new women's faces as they raised their hand to go into this Congress, they were inspired.
Yes.
You're inspiring people now to read a book of what you're talking about, end of life, in such a candid way. You talk candidly about death and how we leave this earthly plane. One of my favorite stories was you talk about Dick and Nikki and Louise and Marilyn. And when you contemplate, oh, how am I going to go? Am I going to go like them? That's such a common thing that people don't share out loud.
Mm.
How did you come to do that?
I don't know, because I've been thinking about it. And I do confess, as you get older, you think about the options, the possibilities, as you watch your friends and relatives die, suddenly peel off or slowly fade away, you can't help but think about it. And I'm also living in a retirement community where you see more people dying or becoming ill or handicapped. It's not that I'm obsessed by it. I mean, I'm more interested in life than in death, but it's there. It's a presence. And as I think I say in the book, it's like seeing a black crow sitting on your shoulder, and even when he flies away, you know he's in the neighborhood. So you know the time in front of you is much shorter than the time behind you that has elapsed.
And what doesn't really elapse in a way is mourning. You said that mourning does not have an end point, and I thought that was very poignant.
Well, I think that's true. You get more accustomed to the absence of a person, but you never totally forget. And I'm certainly experiencing that with the loss of my husband. And maybe that's the way we have immortality, as long as our loved ones will remember us.
Yes, because we do live in their heart.
Yes.
And it goes on and on. Now, what does your family look like?
Well, my children are all grown up, and they're all in satisfying work and careers. I have 6 grandchildren. So it's a nice stage of life, and I'm fortunate that they don't live too far away, even though they all have busy lives. But they all live on the East Coast. 2 of my children are practically neighbors, and a third one is sort of a dual allegiance to Canada and the United States. My daughter lives in New York. So we can all get together for birthdays and holidays and celebrations.
You talk about self-definition in the book. Do you think your need for self-definition has been fulfilled by writing this book?
Well, I think it's a start, but it's an ongoing process. I mean, you change a bit every day, get new insights. So I think it helps to write a memoir so that you can see your own life in perspective. You know, maybe if you wrote it another year, it would be different. So you're still evolving as long as you're alive. You're still growing, changing, gaining things, losing things. But I think it's a very enjoyable process. I mean, you discover things about yourself in the process of writing that you hadn't had time to think about while you were in the midst of life and all its pressures.
You say in the book that no memoir appears complete for those who are close to the writer. Just as we cannot see ourselves accurately in the mirror, we cannot portray ourselves as others see us. How do you think you have portrayed yourself?
Well, the only way I knew how. My children might see it differently, but my husband was in tune with my writing. He read almost all of this memoir before he died, and he read all of my writing and encouraged me to write. He just was a cheerleader for my writing and very supportive of the things I did in public life. But I think someone else might see something different in it. I mean, your life isn't written in cement, except maybe on your tombstone. But in reality, different people see different parts of us and interpret them. I also wrote this memoir to fill out the empty spaces of who I am. You know, when you're in public life, you're either Democrat or Republican, you're either liberal or conservative, and it's a very limited yes, no, black and white description, where most of our lives are made up of nuances that aren't so set and so prescribed. That's why I wanted to write about my father. I never talked about my father in public life, but the loss of my father certainly shaped who I have become. So the memoir permitted me to be more open and more defined.
You also, in the essence of who you are, keep hope alive. In the speech that you gave at the First Women's March, you quoted at the end a poem called Hope by Emily Dickinson. Hope is a thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. I read this book and it is so precious in a way of your stories, your rawness, your intellect, your humor. But I want to end basically with a quote from your book that I found very profound. I know that death is close, but life is always closer. May you stay close to that life. May we all stay close to your stories, your sharing, and may we all become that vulnerable, that courageous to look at our lives in the way that you have. And I appreciate it immensely, and I appreciate you spending time with us today.
Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure to speak with you. I've enjoyed the interview very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the honor. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Through the Eyes of Women. I've been your host, Brenda Starr, and I've been speaking with Governor Madeleine Cunin about her new book, Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. This extraordinary memoir is available through Green Writers Press. For more information about Madeleine May Cunin, her life and books can be visited at madeleinecunin.org. That's MadeleineKunin.org. Through the Eyes of Women is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University. Thanks to today's engineer and editor, Jessica Eden, and to the entire Through the Eyes of Women team. To listen to this program again, visit the KHSU archives or our blog at khsuwomen.com, where you can also learn more about the show and post listener comments. Join us again next Monday at 1:30, right here on KHSU.